We're talking about new legislation called the CNA Pay Act. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Three pieces of legislation would increase wages and expand access to training for certified nursing assistants and personal caregivers who work at long-term care facilities. You can join in, especially if you work as a CNA. The number is 800-642-1234. Are you part of the aging population that relies on a professional caregiver? How have they helped you? Do you employ CNAs? What is turnover like? Would a pay bump benefit your facility or hurt your bottom line? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa Subek is a Democratic state representative from Madison, representing Wisconsin's 78th Assembly District. Representative Subek, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So the CNA Pay Act is this combination of three different pieces of legislation that's meant to really help the nursing assistant shortage. You're targeting a very specific slice of our workforce. Why design legislation around CNAs?
Sure. So we designed this legislation at CNAs and other personal caregivers. And what we know is that we have a huge shortage already in CNAs, and that shortage is projected to grow. Over the next 12 years, Wisconsin's elderly population will reach over 1.5 million. And right now, we already have a 19% average caregiver vacancy rate among our long-term care facilities. And again, that's projected to grow as the aging population grows. And these are the folks who are providing frontline care. They are the people who are working every single day with senior citizens, with people with disabilities, who are taking care of our most vulnerable neighbors, our most vulnerable family members, and someday us as we grow older and need their care.
So explain the purpose of each bill. What does this entail?
Sure. So our package of bills, the CNA Pay Act, has three bills involved in it. The first two really deal with the front end. We know that many of our programs to train caregivers have waiting lists. So we want to try to, you know, get through those waiting lists, get people into the field. We also know this is unfortunately a very low paying field and we need to raise that. So our first two bills, which deal with the front end, one would expand access to CNA training by providing grants to tech colleges and underserved areas, areas where our shortages are the worst. The second bill would actually provide a tax credit to CNAs who receive training here in the state. They go through an education program. And if they stay in Wisconsin and continue working in Wisconsin, we would then provide them a tax credit to cover the cost of their training. The third part of the bill really looks at the other end. And we know that retention rates are incredibly low among CNAs. So we have to address the getting people in the field. But people are also leaving this field at record rates. You know, the average turnover within our facilities ranges, you know, around 61% in the last report for full-time caregivers turned over the course of a year. Part-timers were even higher, about 75% over the course of the year. So we know we need to figure out how do we get people to stay in these jobs. And that means more pay. The average pay for a CNA is $10.75 an hour. That compares to $12 an hour for unskilled non-healthcare jobs. So somebody gets into a CNA position, it is a lot of responsibility, it is hard work, and they can turn around and work in retail for more money. So we see people leaving.
Is the issue that there are people who would like to be CNAs, but they just don't have access to the training? Or is it that current workers are leaving the profession?
Sure.
Where is that give and take and that, you know, that basically the back and forth there?
Absolutely. You know, it's a combination of the two. Certainly, we know that there are people trying to get into the profession who can't get access to the training. We also know that we need to do more to attract people to the profession. But what attracts people? And all of the surveying, all of the research that's been done says people need to feel like they're supported in those positions and they need to make a living wage and they need to be able to support their families. And right now, with, you know, an average starting wage of $10.75 an hour, somebody can't support their family on that job. That's why we propose to raise Medicaid reimbursements for these services. And we tie that increase in reimbursement directly to worker pay. That in order to be eligible for the increased reimbursement, nursing homes, care facilities would need to actually pay their frontline staff more at the same time.
We're talking with Lisa Subic. She is a Democratic state representative from Madison, representing Wisconsin's 78th Assembly District. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Do you have a friend or relative in this field of work? What have you said about issues they're currently facing? And are you part of the aging population that benefits from a CNA? How have they helped you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. This legislation was also introduced in 2017 when you said there was about 11,000 vacant personal care worker positions. Now you say this has grown to about 16,000 vacancies. What do you think? Why do you think it didn't pass the first time?
You know, during the last session, we couldn't even get a hearing. And I think that the Republican-controlled legislature just didn't see this as a priority. I think that now that we are all hearing, and certainly I know I've had folks from Oakwood Village and other nursing facilities in my district come in and talk to me. And I've had constituents talk to me. I met with a constituent at her home a few weeks ago who was telling me about her struggles getting personal caregivers to come in and provide the services that she needs. She has some physical disabilities and needs care for those. But because the pay is so low and because Medicaid reimbursements haven't kept up, she can't get the people into her home that she needs. And every time she gets somebody, they turn around and leave. And they're often not leaving for another nursing job. They're leaving to go work at a restaurant or at a retail store where they can, where the work is less grueling for more money. So, you know, I think that this is reaching a point where it needs to be addressed. And I'm keeping that pressure on my Republican colleagues. Certainly, we've heard that the governor wants to address this issue. He put some money in his budget to address it. And, you know, we want to follow that lead and make sure that we really make it happen.
So help me out with these hourly wages. CNAs are paid $10.75 here in Wisconsin on average, $10.75 an hour.
Starting wage.
This act is set to increase wages to $11.55 an hour.
No, this act doesn't specify the amount it increases.
Okay.
Essentially, what we do is we increase the Medicaid reimbursement. We would accept the federal Medicaid expansion money because we have to pay for this somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that is money that we all have paid to the federal government and taxes, and we want to bring it back to the state and put it directly into increasing reimbursements for personal caregiver services. That 2.5% that we put in there in that increase would be tied to increasing worker wages. Now, we know wages are different from facility to facility. $10.75 is an average starting wage. They vary somewhat, but we put more money into the system to begin increasing those wages. And I'll tell you, that's a start. You know, we will not get to where we need to be. We won't get to a living wage on this alone. But this is a big step forward that we could then look ahead into the future to continue to work on this problem.
We're talking about a package of bills. It's called the CNA Pay Act, designed to address a nursing assistant shortage here in Wisconsin. State Representative Lisa Subic introduced the legislation last week alongside several of her Democratic colleagues. And you have a line to the representative at 800-642-1234. Do you see a shortage of certified nursing assistants where you work? Do you work at a long-term care facility as a CNA? Do you plan to stay? Or does the pay make it difficult for you to stay in the job? You can call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it's a State Capitol Report. We're talking about the CNA Pay Act. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The package of bills is designed to increase wages for certified nursing assistants and personal caregivers. There are more than 16,000 vacant care positions here in Wisconsin, and the average entry-level hourly wage is $10.75. Do you work as a CNA? What led you to this career? What is your quality of life like on the job? How is your pay? And let's hear from operators of long-term care facilities. What would a boost in pay do for recruitment and retention and perhaps your balance sheet? We're at 800-642-1234. You have a line to Democratic Representative Lisa Subak of Madison, who was one of the lawmakers who introduced this legislation last week. Let's go right to the phones now with Emily joining us from Lake Mills. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
What's on your...
I just wanted to thank them for introducing this. I'm a CNA, and we make horrible pay, and it's hard work. It's hard physical work, and I'm really glad that there's someone looking out for us.
Emily, how long have you been a CNA?
A year.
How has it been going? What is the setting you're working in?
I work in a very nice setting. I'm very fortunate, but it's really hard to get people to want to do the work for the pay.
Do you see CNA colleagues come and go? Is there turnover where you are?
Oh, there's horrible turnover no matter where you are, because people go on to bigger things where they can get paid more money.
Emily, thanks for the call. Representative, it sounds like that is exactly where this legislation is designed to go.
Exactly. And thank you, Emily, for the work that you do. I know many caregivers get into this field because they care about people, because they want to do this work. Unfortunately, too many find themselves unable to sustain their families or their lifestyles while they're doing that work. Thank you again, Emily, for calling, and thank you for the work that you do.
Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers recently signed an executive order that's aimed at establishing a statewide task force on caregiving. Does this proposal relate at all in any way to that decision?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it is great that the governor wants to have a task force on long-term caregiving. Caregiving takes many formats. I think his task force will address this issue as well as many others. We hear from folks who are family caregivers, who are taking care of a family member and the challenges they face, the challenges that people face going in and out of the workforce as they care for an aging or a disabled family member. So I think that task force will have a broader impact than just this, but certainly, I mean, this is a problem that's on everyone's minds. It's not just here in Wisconsin. This is a problem throughout the nation in many states. But I am glad that we have a governor who's ready to tackle this issue. We have to get serious about this.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Nancy joining us from Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning. Years ago, I was a CNA over at our county nursing home, and a couple of us got together and we decided maybe we should have a union, and we did. We got the union in, and we were good employees of the county. We took care of our neighbors and our neighbors' parents, and, you know, we all kind of knew each other. Well, after I retired, that was the end of the union. They decided, nope, they were not going to have a union anymore. And now, you know, there are a lot of agency people come in, and it's a different caregiving situation now, because years ago you used to take care of your neighbors or your neighbors' parents. We were all family, and now it's changed, and we got good benefits when we had a union, and, you know, and so anyhow, that's my story.
Nancy, thank you.
I think the union was good.
Thank you for calling in, Nancy. Representative Subak, Nancy saw the before and after of unionizing.
Absolutely. And, you know, certainly unions play a role in ensuring that we have really good working conditions and in increasing pay. In the absence of the unions, this problem has only gotten worse.
Let's go to Maureen now, joining us from Madison. Maureen, hi. Oh, are you there?
Hello there.
Hi, Maureen.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, it's actually Glory. Yes, I have a question, too, about how can we encourage even students from, you know, like MATC or from the tech colleges to start getting into the field, or even coming from high school, for that matter. I'm a nursing manager, and we're having a turnover rate of 60%. That is horrific. And, you know, we just cannot retain staff.
Well, a facet of your bill gives $500,000 in grants to technical colleges.
Absolutely. The part of our bill that relates to grants to technical colleges, as well as that tax credit to, for people to be able to deduct their training costs, both address that front end. I will emphasize, though, that it would be even better if we could get rid of that 60% turnover rate that you're seeing, Corey, that this is the real challenge. I mean, in our state, we lost, they estimate, over 10,000 CNAs to jobs outside of the nursing field or outside of healthcare in 1 year alone, last year. Yet we have 16,000 vacant positions. That would be 10,000 less if we could keep those folks there. So while bringing people in the front end is crucially important, and that's why we do address that too. If we could increase pay and get people to stay in the field, we would eliminate some of that challenge, some of that need for more people. We'd also cut costs, costs that's spent on turnover, on training new people, on recruiting new people, is money that can't go into wages, and we need to turn that around.
Well, one of the bills that is part of this proposal, as you mentioned, would create this tax credit for tuition costs for CNAs. How much does it cost to receive this degree?
Sure. So it depends exactly where you receive it. I mean, we're talking about a couple thousand dollars. This is not the most expensive tuition. Yet, if you're going into a field where the average starting wage is $10.75 an hour, that's a lot of money. So our goal is, as an incentive, to not only have people take this program and finish it, but to actually come in, work in Wisconsin, and stay in the field. You would then get a tax credit after a period of time in the after a period of time working in the field here in the state.
We have Karina from Menominee, who has been a CNA for 22 years, and writes to us that the shortage is bad, that there are nursing homes closing, work dangerously short all time. The care that elderly people get, she says, is criminal, but the nursing homes say that they are working with the legal number of CNAs. Do we see this on staffing in terms of having the a correct number of staffing of CNAs at facilities?
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, Leading Age did a study on this. It's a conglomeration of different healthcare organizations. And what they found is more people are being forced to have staff work overtime. More sites are being forced to have staff, you know, increase their number of hours, work beyond what they normally would. And that sites are actually having to turn patients away, that they have vacant beds that they're leaving vacant because they don't have enough nursing care workers to care for the folks who would fill those beds. And this is a crisis. It absolutely is a crisis. CNA jobs are hard. And as long as we don't compensate people properly for them, and as long as we don't work to try to make those jobs easier by ensuring we have adequate staffing, folks will continue to leave.
Well, Republican State Representative Kathleen Bernier recently released a statement saying we also need to be competitive in the worker shortage. So that is part of why we put in a 2% last biennium, that this went directly to the CNAs. What are your thoughts on this? Is this enough?
Sure. So, you know, our mechanism is a little different than what was done in the last biennium. There was a Medicaid increase in reimbursement. What we do with ours is we do tie it. You do not get the reimbursement unless the whole thing is tied to increasing worker pay. And I think that's a critical piece, because while I believe that our nursing facilities need more money in general, the reality is we need to do even better than our bill does. This first step helps increase worker pay. We have to become competitive. And what we are doing right now is not enough. That's why we propose to increase it.
Well, Matt from Appleton is wondering, why hasn't the shortage driven up the price of labor, the starting wage?
You know, nursing care is a Medicaid-driven industry largely. The vast majority of the patients who are being cared for are covered by Medicaid. So as long as Medicaid reimbursements stay very low and lower than private insurers will reimburse, these facilities don't have the money to pay the workers more. I mean, this really is tied to how we pay for this care.
Well, as we start to wrap up here and you look forward to the CNA Pay Act and this package, what are the next steps here? Where does it go?
Sure. So right now the bill is circulating for co-sponsorship. Once that period closes, it will get formally introduced to the legislature. The three bills will be referred to committees. Now, last session, they got stopped in committees. The Republican committee chairs refused to hold hearings on them. I am hopeful that we'll see something different this time. And I'll certainly be working with my colleagues to try to make that happen. Assuming that they would get through committees, they would then come to the floor for votes and potentially go to the governor's desk for signature.
Well, Representative Subic, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lisa Subic is a Democratic state representative from Madison, representing Wisconsin's 78th Assembly District. And we've been talking about a package of bills called the CNA Pay Act. Up next, it's news. Then the State Capitol Report continues. We're recapping the three recent rulings on Wisconsin's lame duck legislation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are four lawsuits challenging December's lame duck session of the legislature. There's a lot to keep track of as these lawsuits work their way through the courts. And we know that some of the lawsuit laws that limit the powers of Governor Tony Evers went back into effect last week when an appeals court overruled a Dane County judge. Your questions about the litigation and its impact, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you think the lame duck legislation should stand as is, or should it all be struck down? Why or why not? How do you feel about Wisconsin pulling out of the lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Laurel White by our side. She is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter and co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I always laugh when State House reporters say they've turned into court reporters, but it seems like this could be a very fair statement to make. Yes. At present day, there is a lot of litigation involving state politics. So let's break this down. First, lame duck laws were blocked, then reinstated. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the suit before Dane County Circuit Judge Richard Neese. What was that lawsuit claiming and how did he rule?
So I can't believe it, but it was just a week ago today that there was a hearing in this case. This case was a procedural argument. So basically what happened was this wasn't a week ago today. That was a different case. But regardless, I'll tell you what happened in it. So this was a procedural argument where essentially plaintiffs were arguing that lawmakers didn't have the authority to call a special session to begin with, because the power to call a special session, which is a time when lawmakers want to get together that's not on their regularly scheduled, you know, kind of session time, isn't prescribed in the state constitution. It's something that's written into rules. And so plaintiffs in this lawsuit argued because that power isn't ascribed in the state constitution, lawmakers didn't have the authority to call this special session that became the lame duck. And so therefore, everything that is done under this purview should be considered unconstitutional and invalid.
What actions did Governor Evers take in response to this ruling right away?
Mm-hmm. So when Judge Neese agreed with that argument and struck down the entire lame duck session, all of the laws passed within it, all of the appointments made within it, Governor Evers was pretty quick to act on one thing in particular, and it's something that's probably not surprising to people that have been watching state politics. He moved to withdraw Wisconsin from a multi-state lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. That was something that Governor Evers campaigned on, something that he was planning on doing, but Republican lawmakers during the lame duck session passed a restriction on his power to do that. Essentially, he would have to get approval from a panel of state lawmakers to move forward with that. That was a layer of control for lawmakers that wasn't there before under Governor Walker. So when that lame duck layer of power was stripped away, Governor Evers was quick to say, we're going to withdraw from this lawsuit. So he directed Attorney General Josh Call to do so, and Call got that process going.
So the judge rules the lame duck legislation unconstitutional because of this extraordinary session. And this wasn't Wisconsin's first session of this kind. Do we know if this ruling would impact the laws passed during previous extraordinary sessions?
So Judge Neese said in his ruling that this was intended only to affect the December 2018 extraordinary session. The argument of his decision having an effect on a multitude of other special sessions is something that defendants in the case have really pointed out. There have been about two dozen of these sessions since 1980. They've done, obviously, a variety of things. A number of different bills have been passed during these sessions. And so they said, if you invalidate this form of gathering of state lawmakers that's been happening for 40 years, look at all these laws that are going to be struck down. But Judge Neese said, nope, I'm limiting my decision. This isn't something that's going to be affected. Now, that could change as this decision has been appealed. An appellate court could say this argument applies too broadly and this would have too much of an effect. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in future arguments in court.
So how did Republican leaders respond to this ruling? What actions did they take?
So they did file an appeal very quickly. They filed an appeal to the District 3 Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, which is in central Wisconsin. It's based in Wausau. What's interesting about the appeals process for these cases is that Republican lawmakers have passed a law fairly recently that allows them to appeal this kind of case anywhere they want in the state. So folks were kind of keeping an eye on where they chose to file this appeal. There was some thought about it being potentially filed, in the suburban Milwaukee area. But they did decide to go ahead and go with Wausau. Remarkable as well. I know this is kind of down in the details, but the two judges that are sitting on that Milwaukee area court where they could have filed the appeal are both running for the state Supreme Court, Lisa Neubauer and Brian Hagedorn. So if they had filed the appeal there, that could have had political implications for those candidates.
So they filed in Wausau, mm-hmm. and basically the judge said, no, keep lame duck session laws as is?
That's right. So this was a panel of three judges, which was how that was decided in the appellate court. And basically what they said is we are going to fulfill Republican lawmakers' request for what's called a stay of the lower court's ruling. So basically they said, we are going to put a halt on the previous ruling. It doesn't need to be enforced while we're waiting for our arguments and our case to move forward. So they have set briefing deadlines for the plaintiffs and defendants in this case. They need to file all those papers by the end of this month, the end of April, officially. So that's going to be moving forward with arguments, but they haven't made a final decision yet. They've just agreed to put a stay in place, so Judge Neese's decision doesn't need to be enforced.
Talking with Laurel White, she's WPR's State Capitol reporter. You can join in. Do you think the lame duck legislation should be left as is, or should it all be struck down? Why or why not? What questions do you have about these court cases? How do you feel about Wisconsin pulling out of the lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Laurel, last Monday, another judge heard another case against the lame duck legislation. What brought this case and what are they claiming?
So this is the case that was heard a week ago today. This is a case that's focused more on some of the specific laws that are passed or that were passed during the lame duck session. It says that they violate the separation of powers guarantee within the state constitution. So some of the things that were passed during the lame duck session, as we've talked about, are limits on Governor Evers withdrawing from the multi-state federal lawsuits. There are limits on Attorney General Josh Call and some of the actions that he can take. It gives powers to state lawmakers to hire private lawyers if they want private lawyers to defend them in cases when laws are challenged. So this lawsuit contended that a number of those actions give lawmakers and the legislature an inordinate amount of power over the executive branch, and that really violates what the state constitution is seeking to do in terms of balance of power.
Yeah, so this one's more about balance of power. By Tuesday, Judge Frank Remington's ruling came out on that case. Where did he come down on the claims?
So he said that some of the lame duck laws did indeed do that, but not all of them.
Okay.
So unlike Judge Neese that struck down the entire lame duck session, all of the laws, all of the appointments, Judge Remington only struck down some. He struck down that limitation on the multi-state federal lawsuits. He said it's not right that the legislature can limit the governor in withdrawing from those. But he upheld some of the lame duck laws that limit the governor's ability to change federal waivers. Federal waivers were used by the Walker administration to do things like create work requirements for things like food stamps and Medicaid or drug testing for those things. If that law hadn't been changed during the lame duck session, Governor Evers could have come in and rolled back those requirements that Governor Walker put into place. With the lame duck laws in, and what Judge Remington upheld, is that he'd have to go through the legislature to do that.
Let's bring in Steve now, joining us from Sun Prairie. Good morning, Steve.
Morning. So it appears to me, and this is a question, but, you know, here is a liberal judge from Madison that was elected only by basically Madison area residents, who basically just said that a legislator's term ends roughly, what, 45 days before the statutes call their term to end? Is that what I'm hearing?
So essentially, that's definitely an argument that Republican lawmakers have made, is that, you know, the extraordinary session was called when they were still in office. Obviously, the new governor hadn't been sworn in, the new legislature hadn't been sworn in, and they had the authority to do whatever they thought was necessary before that term ended. So that's definitely part of the argument. I think what the plaintiffs in these cases are arguing is that those actions were out of balance with what lawmakers should have been able to do within that time. So that's kind of the push and pull of these lawsuits as they move forward.
Laurel, going back to this balance of power lawsuit, how have Republicans responded to that? How did they respond to this ruling, and have they taken further action?
So they haven't officially taken action yet. I don't believe they've filed the appeal, but we do know that they plan to appeal Judge Frank Remington's ruling as well. So we'll see an appeal of that and potentially, like we did in the Neese case, a stay of Judge Remington's ruling.
Let's look at these 82 government Walker appointments in the last few days of his administration. They were confirmed during the lame duck session. What's happened regarding those positions while these rulings have come down?
So I think this is arguably the most confusing element as these lame duck lawsuits move forward, which is really saying something. Governor Walker did appoint these 82 individuals, and the Senate confirmed them during the lame duck session. These are positions that are mostly on state boards and commissions. Generally, those represent different professions in the state, help regulate them, et cetera. Basically, what happened is when all of those were invalidated by Judge Neese's ruling, Governor Evers moved to officially rescind all of those appointments and make all of those positions vacant so he could reappoint them. Where the confusing element comes in is the appeal of that decision and the ruling by the appellate court struck down Judge Neese's ruling, which Republican lawmakers say put all of the Walker appointees back in place. But Governor Evers doesn't agree with it. He says that the positions are still vacant.
So we're going step by step here through this lame duck litigation, where things stand with the powers of Governor Evers and Attorney General Josh Call. Laurel White is our guide. She is WPR's State Capitol reporter. You have a line at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute, maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the lame duck session litigation, the four lawsuits brought against what happened in December in the legislature's extraordinary session, and where those suits stand today. Sorting through the courtroom motions, the rulings on this edition of the State Capitol Report, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said last week's appeals court ruling poses a, quote, constitutional crisis. What do you think? We're at 800-642-1234. Do you think the lame duck legislation should be left as is, or should it all be struck down? WPR State Capitol reporter Laura White is our guide and to this lame duck litigation and where it all stands. Let's go to Don now, joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Don.
Good morning. I think the lame duck legislation should all be struck down. This is just another example of overreach and on the part of Scott Walker on behalf of his very wealthy Republican political donors. I would suspect that 90% of Wisconsinites don't benefit from any of that lame duck legislation. Working people don't benefit from this. It's just a favor to his donors and a favor to large corporations.
Don,
that's my opinion. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Don, I wanted to ask you, if you're still there, are you following these lawsuits carefully?
I'm sorry?
Are you following these lawsuits, Don? I'm wondering if you're watching
them.
Yeah. All right. Well, Don, thanks for the call. Laurel, it sounds like Don doesn't feel like any of this litigation would help Wisconsinites.
You know,
legislation.
Right. I think it's interesting because Republican lawmakers said during that lame duck session that they believed that these measures were so important and so helpful to the state economy for a variety of reasons. I'm thinking particularly about what we talked about earlier about those federal waivers and some of those work requirements and drug testing requirements. Those are things that they accomplished with Governor Walker in office. They thought that they would be in danger when Governor Evers came into office, and they believe that they are so important to the state that they wanted to offer some additional kind of insulation and protection around them. So I think that proponents of this lame duck session would argue just the opposite of what Don said, that certainly some of the things are very important and very helpful to Wisconsinites.
Well, let's motor through the final two lawsuits here. One is awaiting an appeal in federal court. Can you help us understand the early voting situation?
So this is a case that was ruled on in January. It's a federal challenge to the lame duck laws that focuses just on these restrictions on early voting. So what the lame duck session did in terms of early voting was say that the amount of time could be limited to just 2 weeks, I believe, before Election Day. The plaintiffs in this lawsuit appealed to a federal judge saying, we believe that this new lame duck legislation violates a previous decision that federal court had made about Wisconsin's voting laws. It was kind of a case that wrapped up voter ID, early voting, a variety of things related to election law in Wisconsin. The judge agreed with them in that case and said, yes, this does violate my earlier ruling. I'm going to put these new lame duck laws on hold. And that case is also pending an appeal. We haven't heard arguments in that federal appellate court yet.
And the Democratic Party of Wisconsin also brought a case against the lame duck session. Mm-hmm. What are they claiming?
So they are claiming another constitutional argument. They're saying that the lame duck laws violate the U.S. Constitution's guarantee clause. And that is a clause that says voters are entitled to a Republican with a lowercase r form of government, which means you vote for a certain number of people. Those people should be able to represent you, essentially saying that voters elected Tony Evers to do a certain set of tasks, and he is limited in his ability to do some of those things.
So have these rulings brought about confusion of what is and isn't law in the state of Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. I think the confusing part about this is the fact that there are these two state cases. As we said, one of them struck down all of the lame duck laws, one struck down just some of them. And then one of those cases, one of those rulings, rather, has been put on hold by an appellate
you
court.
Need
and
a
one,
chart
and
here.
One hasn't.
A chart
right.
is needed.
Really, a pie
a
chart
grid,
would
a grid.
Be great. Yeah. Where is the overlap between these two cases?
Right.
Because the overlap is really what's still on the books. The things that have been struck down by Judge Remington's ruling are, of course, off. Everything done by Judge Neese's ruling is off. But the things that Judge Remington said can't happen anymore, those things are still being limited by that court. So the Affordable Care Act lawsuit, the governor's power in that regard, things like that.
Very quickly, in about 10, 15 seconds here, what kind of movement will we see from any one of these lawsuits?
So we're going to be looking for that appeal in Judge Remington's case, where they file that appeal and whether or not that court issues a stay. My guess is that could happen this week. And then we're obviously going to be keeping an eye out for the arguments and the decisions from these higher courts.
Well, Laurel, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Mm-hmm. When voters head to the polls tomorrow in the small northern Wisconsin city of Barron, they'll be taking part in a historic election. As Rich Kramer reports, for the first time since Somali refugees began settling there 20 years ago, a Somali-born American is running for local office.
Let's all try saying that one time.
In a side room at the Barron Public Library, a group of five Somali refugees are studying for upcoming U.S. citizenship tests. They must memorize answers to 100 questions about U.S. history, the Constitution, and its separation of powers.
This is General Eisenhower.
Muhammad Farah moved to Barron in 2005 and obtained his citizenship the next year. He works at the Genio Turkey Store production plant in town, takes classes at UW-Eau Claire, Barron County, and volunteers as a translator for the citizenship classes. He says Somalis have become a part of the community, but until now they haven't sought public office. He says people have asked him about it.
How come you guys are absent? You know, you guys are a big community and you guys are absent from where decisions are made, and you guys should be part of it, and you know, at least we're taking that step.
That step was taken when two Somali candidates ran for an at-large city council seat in February.
No matter if they win or lose, what is important is, like, we have that ambition. And the local elections, usually Somalis don't pay attention, local stuff, you know, the general election is, you know, the one that they follow.
After a primary, 33-year-old Isak Mohammed became the first Somali-born candidate running in a city general election. Mohammed says a lack of housing and youth programs are two major issues for the Somali community and city as a whole.
I want to tell Barron community that they want to see us, that we can be involved in the government by starting the local government, so that we can do a good job by helping this community, by helping the U.S. government.
Mohammed says his journey to Barron began in 2006 when he fled a bloody civil war in Somalia for a Ugandan refugee camp. He lived in that country for about 8 years before being resettled in the U.S. in 2013. Soon, he heard from friends there was plenty of work in Barron. His first job was at the Genio Turkey Store, and he's now a liaison for the Barron Area School District, where the number of black or African-American students has tripled to 164 since 2005. Mohammed is facing Paul Soley. He's a Barron native who worked on sewer projects in nearby Grantsburg and also did missionary work in Africa. When he moved back to Barron in 2013, he noticed a lack of participation in city government. He says he would be honored to work with the growing Somali population.
I'm sure that they are facing different issues than what the generations that have been here before. So those things will have to be faced. And I think that some of that is housing and child care.
The 2010 census showed nearly 9% of the city's 3,400 residents were of African descent. But a city administrator says that could have been an undercount. Despite some early tensions with longtime residents, the Somali community is a visible part of the city. Workers flowing into the Genio Turkey Store include women in hijabs. There are two mosques on the main road through the city's old downtown, and at least two Somali-owned businesses have opened there, including the Bushra Fashion Shop, run by Fadumo Sal Hassan. Hassan sells clothes, perfumes, beauty products, and an assortment of East African foods. She says having a Somali resident in local government could help raise awareness about issues facing the community, like immigration.
We would love to have someone who can be a liaison for this community in both ways. He would be a voice for anyone who speaks Somali or would represent in the city council.
No matter who wins the city council race, members of the Somali community in Barron say seeing one of their own running for office has already had an impact. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And your go-to source for election news and information is WisconsinVote.org. There you can find your polling place, register to vote, view your sample ballot, and a lot more. The site is WisconsinVote.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.